This is Using the Whole Whale, a podcast that brings you stories of data and technology in the nonprofit world. This is George Weiner, your host and the chief whaler of WholeWhale.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probable that you have missed the chance to vote in more elections than you've actually voted in elections. And this is something that really frustrates today's guest, Seth Flaxman, who is a co-founder of Democracy Works. Welcome to episode 13, where we're going to be talking with Seth about how they use big data and aggregated polling locations in order to make it easier for people to vote via absentee ballot. This project gained the attention of little-known companies like Google, who actually contacted them for that database. So we're going to talk with them and see where this project is going. Seth, thank you for having us here today on the podcast. You work for and you are the founder of Democracy Works, but tell us a bit more. Who are you and what do you do?
Co-founder, actually.
Co-founder.
I have to make sure to give Katie credit, you know, if you're holding up half the organization.
So tell me, what do you guys do?
So the idea is to use technology to make a seamless, modern voting system for everyone. That's the sort of 30,000 feet view. And TurboVote is the main sort of program we have, a site. And the idea there is that anyone should be able to sign up online one time and then get all the help they need to stay registered to vote and voting in all of their elections for the rest of their life. So an entirely voter-centered design voting system. But we just launched this year our second program, which is going to be called Ballot Scout, and it's a tool for local election offices. We did a 9-month technology study to figure out what tech election offices actually wanted and would spend some money to acquire. And what they really want is a way to track all the mail ballots that they're starting to send people more and more. Because in 32 states now, everyone can vote by mail. Every year, more people vote by mail, but the tracking system isn't that good. So ballots get lost. People call them constantly, ask them where their ballots are, haven't been returned. So that's our second program.
So it's pretty crazy to me that something as fundamental, literally baked into our Constitution, the right to vote, is so goddamn complicated. And one of the things I love about your initial approach was that you're trying to make it, as you said, as easy as it is to watch a movie on Netflix. That's how easy voting should be. And you started actually by gathering like a whole bunch of like unstructured data. And can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your process of saying like, you know, tackling voting is a beast.
Yeah.
Where'd you start?
Although I should say, unfortunately, in the U.S. there is no right to vote in the Constitution. This is something.
But I can get bare arms, right?
Right. Yes. Exactly. So, but this—I mean—the U.S. is the only country in the world that doesn't have a federal election system. All of our elections are run by counties and towns, and it's one of the reasons why
every right to badger my electoral college.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with having the oldest continually functioning democracy in the world is you still have all of these sort of patches. Like our whole democracy is a patch upon a patch upon a patch for like 250 years. But the question about the data stuff is interesting. So there's a challenge. If you want to build a single system so that anyone in the country can sign up online and get all the help they need to stay registered and vote in all of their elections, that means that you need to be collecting data from 8,000 different local election offices. So like even the first iteration, when we were doing the pilot in 2010, and we were just going to be helping like a few hundred college students use the system, even during the pilot, we had to have the contact information to the like mailing address information for all 8,000 of those local election offices. So that was the first data challenge that we faced. And we needed all of that address information because one of the ways we make registration, voter registration easy or vote by mail easy is that when you sign up on the site, if you need to register or vote by mail, there's a form associated with that. So we'll mail you that form already printed out, already filled out with a pre-addressed, pre-stamped envelope. So in order to pre-address that envelope, we had to collect all of this data. So, and there's no central repository of it. There's like no nationwide data set of it. So we had to screen scrape every Secretary of State office's website.
Was this a manual or automatic process?
Automatic. Well, we had to build screen scrape.
Yeah.
Yeah, build a screen scraper for every site.
So what exactly is screen scraping? Well, it's kind of like it sounds. You're crawling through a site to find the relevant information you want and saving that to one central database. But instead of having a person do this, i.e. the worst intern task ever, you actually have a little bit of code that crawls the website and looks for the parameters that you set, such as give me an email address that you'd find on here, or give me the location and save that back to the main database. And this is not only time saving, but can create a pretty valuable database of information. If you're interested in doing this for your organization, there's a couple different ways. You can obviously Google screen scraper, see what comes up, but you could also get a developer. You could potentially find them through Odesk. You could find that developer and give them parameters. I want all of this kind of information from all of these kinds of sites. Have them build that algorithm for you, and then let it run and see what kind of data you come back with. All right, let's get back to the interview.
After we had it, we then had to feed it through a postal service address checking API just to make sure that they were all real places, and several of them were not. I would think like five of the states, like Virginia, there was Test Virginia was one of them. It was one of the towns.
Test Virginia is Test a real place?
No.
It's just a developer with a PO box somewhere. So how did you figure that out?
It was through the address checker. But then we had another town in Massachusetts, and we sort of called them to be like, your address, the postal service doesn't know where you are. And they're like, of course they know. It was Barnstable, Massachusetts. And of course the post office knows where we are. We're right across the street. And so there was just a complete, we don't need a accurate address in their minds because they're across the street from the post office in this small town in Massachusetts. So why would a correct
exactly
address matter?
Are.
Right, exactly. So anyway, so that was the first sort of level of challenge. And now what we did is we actually turned all of those screen scrapers into a tool that automatically screen scrapes every month called Dogcatcher. Mm-hmm. And that's how we see whether these addresses are changing and stuff like that. But there's a bunch of other challenges like election dates. You have to collect every single election date in the country. Something a lot of people don't know is that there is an election every single Tuesday somewhere in the country. Somewhere in the country, there is an election every single Tuesday. So we've tried a bunch of different ways to do that. Right now, it's strangely enough, the best way to do it is just setting up hundreds of Google alerts for election, election date, county this, election date, county this. And we have a full-time researcher, and this is part of his job. We spent a whole summer trying to experiment with Mechanical Turk to see if we could collect all the election dates in a sort of more automated way, but the quality wasn't good and it was too hard. So we're still looking for ways to do it more automated.
Mechanical Turk is actually a bit of software that allows people from remote locations to actually complete simple, what they call human intelligence tasks or HITs. And this is all run through Amazon. So you can look up Mechanical Turk and Amazon and see the types of tasks, such as, can you look through these images and find all of the, things in this image, write them down, give them back to me. And so it's kind of like these things that need a little bit more human intelligence to accomplish, all itemized so that people anywhere remotely can work on them. Mechanical Turk actually has a pretty hilarious backstory as well. It came from someone in 1770, a guy named Wolfgang von Kempelen, who created this Mechanical Turk, or automatic chess player, to impress Maria Theresa of Austria. And this automatic chess-playing illusion traveled the country and played people like Napoleon and even Benjamin Franklin. Turned out that it was a hoax, and there was a chess master hiding inside of it to play. So that's a little bit of the backstory on there. All right, let's jump back into the interview.
For now, it's just you blood, sweat, and tears.
No substitute, except no alternatives. So you have all of these data. Tell me a little bit about how your impact measurement, so what, right? It's nice,
yeah.
But so what? I think there have been, I've heard of, actually, other projects that have been able to collect these data. How have you turned that into impact, and what are you measuring?
Mm-hmm. Right, so the idea is we collect all this data, election dates, forms, deadlines, ID rules, addresses, in order to build TurboVote. Then with TurboVote, the goal is, are we actually helping people register to vote, and are we actually helping them vote? Are they actually voting? And right now, there's a huge data challenge to answer that question, because although whether someone votes is publicly accessible information, so you can actually see whether your user did register and did vote, the system is so bad. The only folks who have there's like sort of two or three firms that collect this data nationwide, Catalyst, Target Smart, they only update this information once every 2 years, about right after a federal election. So we only have these brief windows to check in once every federal election to see whether our folks voted. And it's good. Like, we had very high numbers in 2012 that we were really happy with. So of the people who we registered to vote, who were first-time voters, 76% voted in the 2012 election.
And what was the total number of that?
The total number of voters?
Yeah. For you guys.
Oh, yeah, so we actually, I don't remember what number that is off the top of my head. I mean, we signed up around almost 200,000 folks to use TurboVote that year. But yeah, I mean, I honestly, what I would love to see, the metric I would love to have for TurboVote is the percentage of elections someone is voting in over the course of a year over the number of elections they could vote in. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much obsession in our space with the federal elections, when really the way like democracy most like has the most direct impact on someone's life is through their local elections. Like, there are lots of people who care about the quality of education and then don't vote in school board elections. And so we want to increase that sort of ratio and make people realize that a lot of democracy occurs between those 4 years when presidents are elected. But it's so hard to get that data. I don't have a plan for that yet.
At least you know what you don't know, which puts you at least somewhere ahead of where you were before.
Yeah.
But that's a great way of looking at it, sort of like an election penetration number.
Right. And also because, like, if you can get someone to vote in even like two or three elections in a row, it changes their habits and become regular voters for life.
Like brushing your teeth.
Right. Exactly. If you just sort of almost remember every 4 years, you're never going to become a regular voter.
So talk to me about what's coming down the pipe. What are you trying to work on to extend your mission?
I sort of alluded to it a bit before. We have these two big programs. One is TurboVote, and in a sense, that's everything you can do to make voting easier before you work with government. So you just take all the information government has as a raw material and you turn it into an application that sits on top of the platform of government. And now what we're trying to do is to actually sort of become that platform. So to build our first tools that government election officials could use to make voting easier. And one of the reasons why we're doing this and why someone else hasn't done this already is what I was saying before. All of our elections are run at the county level, in 8 states, the town level. And so no VCs are investing in companies that build great affordable technology for county government. There's no real market there. And so we're stepping in as a nonprofit tech startup to build that technology and sell it to them at a sort of affordable rate, and just because we want elections to be run better.
So this is hilarious. In order to be this type of solution, you realize after looking at the marketplace and gathering this information, you found a problem and you're like, if we can fix the infrastructure of this, then we can get back to our ultimate goal, which is to get more goddamn people to vote.
Right.
We gotta fix literally the goddamn plumbing of everything that's going on.
Right, exactly. It's like you have to get all the gunks out of the pipes in our democracy and then see where we actually are. Right now, we don't have a clear picture of what our participation rates actually are, because the whole system is designed to decrease turnout as opposed to make turnout easy.
I mean, I feel like that's a topic for a whole other podcast on the terms of ease of voting and disenfranchisement.
Oh my god, I would love to geek out on the history of voting.
What is your favorite tidbit that you think people don't know about the history of voting?
Oh, so why do we vote on a Tuesday? That is my favorite question. There's a whole nonprofit that's called Why Tuesday. It's like such an interesting question.
Yeah, no clue.
So we vote on a Tuesday because in the 1700s, Sunday was church day, so you couldn't vote on Sunday. That's God's day. You're a church. Then Monday, you would travel to the county seat. If you were in George Washington's district, you would stay over at his house. He'd like get a lot of beer. You'd party at his house. Then Tuesday morning, you would go to the town square. The two candidates would line up, and one at a time, the white, wealthy landowners would shake the hand of the candidate they wanted to support in front of everyone. and you'd have time to then travel back home that afternoon in time for market day on Wednesday. So from the beginning of the U.S., voting was supposed to fit the way we live and be really seamless and convenient. And instead, we're just still voting like we live in the 1700s in a farming society.
Although I feel like it'd be pretty damn cool to shake Obama's hand. Be like, yeah, I got you back.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Not terribly effective.
One of the few things people know is that the highest participation in voting happened in sort of the Lincoln era, the mid-1800s. We had like 70-80% participation in elections. And what you would do is you would grab the parties would hand out ballots, like already filled out, and you would choose the ballot you wanted. And then you would drop that filled out ballot in the ballot box. And it was important to have that because so many people couldn't read. So you had to be able to grab a filled out ballot. After the end of the Civil War and the sort of freeing, you know, the first like black Americans voting, that's when we invented the ballot booth and the ballot, because it kept illiterate people from voting, specifically black voters from voting. So even the invention, it was called the Australian ballot. It was taken from there and then adopted nationwide almost overnight in like 1870s. So it's just I love these stories like this because it shows that our voting system is not set in stone. We change it for all sorts of political reasons over time, and we can like continue changing.
Gerrymandered the heck out of it.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about how it seems like you do think with a plumbing mindset, right? We have to look up the river for types of solutions. How do we look at a system as a whole? Tell me a little bit about your working with APIs.
Mm-hmm. One of the things we're excited to be doing next year is we realize that the whole TurboVote application runs in all of this data. And we're going to open up each of those sort of data feeds as its own individual API so other people can build interesting tools on top of it. So we're going to be building an API of every election date so that if you want to build your own type of reminder tool about election dates.
Are you charging for use?
Not for the raw election data.
It's mind-blowing that nobody does this.
It's mind-blowing.
The government should be free.
I forgot to finish my story here. Even when when we did the pilot in 2010, we built this data set of local election offices.
Yeah.
We were just sharing it on Sunlight Labs list or a few other lists, being like, here's this list. It's like useful. We put it together for our pilot. No one else has this. And someone from Google reached out to us, was on that list, and say, that's amazing. That's the cleanest, most complete list of that type I've seen. We're going to use it. And we'd like to give you a grant. So,
how do you do?
Yeah. Oh, and that's actually, I thought that's how fundraising worked after that. And it's like not, true at all.
Yeah, there,
oh, that's
stuff,
amazing.
And then Google just drops you a check.
Right. Yeah. Not
that's
true.
That's how.
But it was just amazing to us that sort of three of us working at that point while we're still in grad school part time, and we put together a data set that Google wants to use because no one else had done it.
That's fantastic. So talk to me, you're opening up these APIs, and instead of doing what I think a for-profit would have done, which is, it's mine, it's ours, and if you pay us an exorbitant fee, we will bestow this information to you. I love it. That's why the not-for-profit sector is, I think, our greatest hope for where technology needs to go, because of exactly this type of story.
Right, yeah. This is like public data that belongs to everyone, and it should reinforce the whole civic tech space, and a whole, like, 1,000 different ideas should bloom.
Yeah, data.gov, if you're listening, come on. And a final question here. You're gathering these data, you're creating systems. What is it going to take, do you think, to move the needle on turnout? What is the tipping point, and what is the role of technology in hitting this tipping point?
So we work a lot with college students. Right now we have 125 college partners, and what that means, they actually pay us annual partnerships fees as part of our model, and we build them a version of TurboVote with their logo and everything on it, and then they put their site like by class registration. So like everyone who registers classes signs up for TurboVote, or it could be freshman orientation or something else. So like a bottleneck point that every student has to pass through. And college students are an amazing population for this question, because in 2010, of the college students who didn't vote, 66% said they didn't vote because of process issues. They forgot, they were working, they were out of town. And these are problems that we can solve. Like, this is the low-hanging fruit of turnout. Build a system that makes vote by mail easy, that sends reminders, so that you can take out all of the process excuses for people. You know, so that's one part of the equation and where I think we can increase turnout, because voting, you know, when you talk to a political scientist, there's a benefit cost analysis for every voter. Does the benefit of voting outweigh the cost of voting? And what politicians do is they usually try to up the benefit by like promising you a bunch of shit. But what we're doing is we're lowering the cost of voting on the other side of the equation. And I think that's the first step to massively increasing turnout. But there's a second part of it where the voting is a social behavior. You vote because your friends vote, your family votes, you know other people are voting, you don't want to be seen like someone who's not voting. And I think my hope is that we can increase turnout enough by making the process easier that we can then sort of create more social pressure for people to vote, especially by making vote by mail easier. I think it actually, a lot of young people especially, if they can like vote next to their laptop, so they're like have their ballot out and they're on Facebook and they're like, hey guys, what the hell is this person's name doing this? Or like, what's this ballot initiative? It actually makes voting more social and more informed.
I'm forced to agree with you in playing with the variables of, you know, ability, motivation, and trigger. If you're moving down the sort of cost and opportunity cost of voting, that's one solution. Aside from keeping the U.S. Postal Service in business, obviously by mailing, how far out is the online ballot?
The online voting is tricky because it has to be both secure and anonymous. So you can bank online because it doesn't have to be anonymous. The bank knows every single click you're doing, and so it can be secure. And they can also, if like they make a mistake and $100,000 moves out, they can put in a different $100,000. Like, money's fungible in a way votes are not. So it's very challenging. I don't think the technology exists now to build a system, an online voting system, that is both secure and anonymous. So one, that's an issue. I actually think the bigger problem beyond the technology is just one big problem, and I don't see any solutions out there right now. I think trust is the bigger problem, especially after like 6 months after all these NSA revelations and Heartbleed, and like this has been a bad year for trust in the internet,
yeah.
And I think that is actually going to set it back even longer. So for now, for me, I think the best we can do in the short term, in the medium term, is seamless vote by mail. Your ballot comes automatically in the mail. You get a text message reminding you to mail it back. We're going to know if you don't vote.
I will find you like
Liam Neeson. Kidnapped. And that's the first step. And then the second step is going to be building trust and figuring out what the technology is and building trust in it. And I don't know how long that will take.
That's a hard thing to measure. Seth, thank you so much for joining us. How do people find you? How do people help you?
If you, there's lots of ways to help us. If you want to give us a grant, you can just email anything at turbovote.org and we'll find you. But if you want to help us partner with a college that isn't already partnered with us, we're trying to get to 300 colleges this year from 125, and you can email info@turbovote.org.
Do you guys have Stanford yet?
We do. We just signed them last week.
We have a couple of Stanford listeners. Nice job, guys.
Yeah, good job. And how else can you help? I don't know. You can just follow us on Twitter and we'll figure it out.
Perfect. And you're
at TurboVote.
Seth, thanks again.
All right, thank you.
Democracy Works and TurboVote are not just doing another Get Out the Vote initiative, which we've been doing for years, and I think seen the results and the upper limits of what happens. They looked at the issue from afar and said, what can we do to make it easier? How do we reduce the activation energy that it takes to vote, to go out there and go on location, especially for a college-bound displaced population? And they landed on absentee ballots, and they said, you know, we're getting movies via mail through Netflix. That's easy enough. Why can't we make it as easy to get a Netflix video to our doorstep and back as it is to send an absentee ballot? And as they chased that question, you see where they kind of ended up. They actually had to create the database, now create the technology, in order to reduce the activation energy. And I do believe that there's an inevitable step toward electronic voting, but as Seth said, it's going to definitely hinge a lot on our relationship of trust as it comes with technology and data security. And it's been a rough year, that's for sure. But I'm still hopeful that a true democracy should be working best when its people are able to vote and also be able to read the ballot, of course. Well, we'll leave it there. Resources on today's podcast can be found at wholewhale.com/podcast. Thanks for joining us. This has been Using the Whole Whale. For more resources on today's show, please visit wholewhale.com/podcast and consider following us on Twitter @wholewhale. And thanks for joining us. I see you're still listening, so I'll keep talking. Special thanks today. If the audio sounds a bit better, well, it's because we have a new team member, Ashik Serafin, who's helping us on audio for the podcast. And in the true tradition and spirit of Using the Whole Whale, I enlisted our front-end whaler, Simon Glengreg, on the banjo. And so we had a banjo recording session. So thank you to both of you.